You're listening to the Alan Gray Podcast. I am Horatia Naidu McCarthy, a manager in the institutional clients team at Alan Gray, and your host for this episode. Today, I am joined by my colleagues, portfolio manager Talia Patusi and investment analyst Uma Kaji, to unpack a fascinating market story currently unfolding: the resurgence of gold as a store of value and currency reserve. As global power dynamics shift and trust in long-standing institutions weakens, the dominance of the US dollar is no longer considered a given. While gold is generally perceived to be a safe haven in times of economic instability or geopolitical uncertainty, the question is the gold rally simply history repeating itself, or are we witnessing the beginning of a paradigm shift? So Talia and Uma, thank you very much for joining me today. You're both old hands at the Alan Gray Podcast, and it's wonderful to have you both back. When I looked at this topic today, for me, it reminded me of a great story that our colleague Sandy McGregor once told me. Going back to the 1980s, time of prescribed assets, there was a very fine print that Alan himself looked at and saw that actually gold formed part of the cash allocation. And so what Alan Gray started to do is they started to buy Kruger Rands into the portfolios. These are physical gold that we held across custodians throughout Johannesburg. And it got to the point where Sandy said he actually picked up the phone after a few years. This was about 1992. And he said to the Saab deputy governor at the time, James Cross, he says, "Would you like to buy some gold?" And he said, "Yes, of course, I'd like to buy some gold." But what this meant was we had armored trucks going and picking up these Kruger Rands and essentially taking them to the smelter. And from the smelter, they went to the Reserve Bank. So it was roughly about 300,000 ounces of gold, which in today's money is about 18 billion rand. So when we talk about history, Talia, you actually wrote something rather fascinating in one of your reports on gold. You mentioned that since the dawn of civilization, humans have always been fascinated with gold, particularly its valuation and supply. You mentioned in 3100 BC, the first Egyptian dynasty assigned gold with a hieroglyph and it placed value on it relative to silver. And then they used it as a currency for barter in 1500 BC in the Middle East. And the earliest surviving geological map was drawn to record the site of gold deposits in 1150 BC. And, you know, Alan always said gold is the ultimate speculation. It's a matter of human psychology. What do you think has been driving the surge in gold prices?
Thanks, Horatia. It's a big question. Yeah. And I think it's one me and Uma are probably going to take a while to unpack. But I would say for me, the most important driver lately, and when I say lately, I mean probably in the last 3 to 4 years, has been central bank buying. That's been the big underpin. Firstly, it's important to unpack which central banks have been buying. And primarily, it's been your BRICS Plus or your emerging market and frontier central banks. And they actually hold quite a low percentage of reserves in gold. So if you look at Western central banks, take the US, for example, they've got 60% to 70% of reserves in gold. Similar for Germany, similar for actually a lot of countries in the European Union. But in emerging markets, it's been a smaller percentage of the mix. So their starting value has been lower. And then there's been quite a shift. And I think some of that shift has been due to the fact that predominantly these BRICS plus countries have held big percentages of their reserves in the US dollar and in treasuries. And their experience of holding US treasuries had not been good. So US treasury returns, we know, had been quite terrible. They'd been negative. We reached a period in 2020 when the 10-year US treasury was paying you a yield of about 0.5%. So it was not keeping up with inflation, and it was also not keeping up with other key assets or key commodities like oil. Now, that's quite important for many countries because a large portion of their FX reserves goes to cushion or support their import demand. And a lot of their imports are oil. So suddenly you have this dynamic where your reserves are not keeping up with the key commodities you're needing to buy. So that was a big one. Then another big reason why I think the BRICS Plus bloc started to want to alter their reserves mix in favor of gold was the experience that Russia had in 2022 after their invasion of Ukraine, when the US placed sanctions on them. And specifically, they sanctioned them such that they could no longer put money transfers through in the SWIFT system. Now, SWIFT is essentially the payment network and channels by which all global money transfers take place. So if you are locked out of SWIFT, you can no longer import anything. You can no longer pay anyone for anything. Now, I think Russia, you know, they've had experiences before with sanctions. This is not their first rodeo in this regard. So they'd actually been de-dollarizing and sanction-proofing their reserves for some time, most notably since their 2008 war with Georgia. At the time, they had about 35% of their reserves in U.S. Treasury holdings. And gradually, they started to draw that down, to sell those reserves held in treasuries. That was actually quite prescient of them, because they were then sanctioned in 2014 after their invasion and annexation of Crimea. So by the time the 2022 invasion of Ukraine happened, they actually had none of their reserves in US treasuries. But I think it made other large EM central banks, and in particular China, sit up and really take notes and think, okay, if we were to ever make a move, for example, to invade Taiwan, there's a very real risk we could be locked out of SWIFT. So China has been one of the big buyers of gold in 2021, 2022, 2023. And in fact, we don't actually have proper data or exact data for how much China's been buying. And just coming back to Russia and their experience post 2022, when they were locked out of SWIFT and there were all these sanctions against them, because they held at that point in time 25% of their reserves in gold. I mean, you'd think, okay, how's this going to help them? I mean, gold's not a very, you know, liquid currency. They held it in physical gold, by the way, in country. How do you then trade and barter with gold? Well, there were many stories in 2022 of Russia actually flying cargo loads of gold into and out of the UAE, China, Venezuela, and parts of Africa, in order so that they could buy goods from them. So, for example, from China, they were importing electrical parts, machinery, warfare equipment, and paying for it with gold and diamonds. So I'll say BRICS plus central banks buying of gold has been a huge underpin, even at a time in 2021, 2022, when exchange traded funds were actually selling gold. US Treasury yields started to rise in 2022. They thought, okay, you can get quite a nice return now. You know, US Treasury is starting to yield 5%. We don't really need to be holding that much gold. I want to hand over to Umar, though, to unpack some of the other drivers, because it's more than just central bank buying.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a few other use cases for gold. There's some use cases in technology, in chemistry. And I mean, the other big driver of gold demand has been jewelry. And before the current rally in the gold price, China and India grew to be the biggest consumers of gold from a jewelry perspective. I mean, India has a long history in regards to that, and China more recently, as the wealth effects from the rise in the Chinese economy that took place over the past 20 years resulted in this more increased consumer spending. I mean, jewelry was a big beneficiary of that, as we saw in the other forms of luxury spending across the region. And as the gold price rallied now to the point going beyond $3,000, I mean, there has been a bit of a pullback, and it's more of a reflection of that price sensitivity that comes with jewelry. It's not like because the gold price increased 100%, people have an additional 100% in their jewelry budgets to buy more jewelry. The balancing factor is that you just buy less, right? You half your ounce. And there's various stories about how those transactions happen in the jewelry stores within China. And apparently, like on the walls, they have like the gold price displayed. So when you go to the counter and you say, I want this piece of jewelry, it's not like there's been a predetermined price tag. It's like in real time, okay, this is the weight in gold. On the calculator, this is the price, and this is how much we're going to charge. And I mean, if you went in with the perception of having a budget of XYZ, and it turns out you can't buy it, you're going to cut the amount that you're actually going to buy, or you're going to choose a different jewelry piece. After this rally, it did take a bit of a dip, especially in the experience here to date. And from another perspective, I mean, platinum is also used in jewelry, and the jewelry wholesalers have been switching their purchasing of gold for the jewelry for platinum. And that's when we also saw the surge in platinum prices over the past 6 months.
Yeah, generally with, you know, the gold price surging,
it brings all the other commodities in their wake. But there's something so interesting that you mentioned about jewelry, and it's this oscillation of gold's use in utility versus a store value. And there's something interesting that I read. It said, you know, during COVID, that demand for jewelry, gold jewelry in India came off a little bit, obviously the lockdowns and that kind of thing. And we're starting to see sort of an improvement in that as time goes on. Something else that is quite interesting is you're mentioning the drivers driving the surge in gold prices, but are we seeing fundamental differences from previous gold rallies to now? The reason I ask this question is because historically, when you look at gold's outperformance, it's at a time when US 10-year yields are low and when markets are weak. And we're seeing, you know, US treasuries sort of stabilizing the pre-liberation day levels, and markets have been strong. Is there a fundamental shift here?
Yeah, so some of the topics that Talia has spoken about, like the element of trust and confidence that if I hold a US treasury, I'm going to get my money back. Or the fact that if I hold US treasury, I'll get a yield that compensates me for inflation. So you retain your purchasing power over that holding period. And I mean, those two aspects, or the trust and confidence that your reserve asset will be able to retain that store value, is not something new. I mean, it's happened over previous monetary regimes in the past. And a big bulk of the research that I've been doing in gold is like, oh, the events that have transpired over, say, these 3-4 years, is it something new, or is it just, you know, more of the same of what has happened before? And so, I mean, long before I was born, the US dollar was not the reserve currency. I mean, before World War One, under the classical gold standard, it was actually the British pound. I mean, at the time, London was the center of trade. Most of the refineries and the mints for mined ore or gold ore was processed in London, and the London bullion market is like the perfect place in order to monetize your gold production, irrespective of where you were mining the gold around the world. And so through that, there was that element of trust that your gold had value if it flowed through London. And under the classical gold standard, I mean, you still had gold sovereign coins that we use as a form of money, like physical coins. You could not just use it as a store of value or reserve asset, but it was actually a unit of exchange. And at the same time, the British pound was pegged to the gold at a fixed amount. And so you could see London and the British pound be the center of trade just for that two reasons. And this element of trust breaking down, it's more in the period in the early 1900s, just before World War, where you saw a lot of countries building up their gold reserves just in anticipation of the war ahead. All of them knew the war was going to be expensive, and the only way to retain the value of your currency is to have this war chest in the form of gold. So, I mean, London, the US, Russia all did the same. They started inwardly retaining the gold production. Funny enough, London started buying a lot of gold from South Africa and Australia. But heading into the war, because the amount of money that was being spent on these arms was far ahead than what could be built up from your gold. Because remember, if you want to print money under the old classical gold standard, you couldn't just do it in the same fashion that we've been doing for the past 30 years. You had to have the physical gold to back it. So there was this precarious point where they needed to spend money on this military for the war, but they didn't have sufficient gold, or the inflow of gold wasn't enough to, you know, supply their money. So I think during the 1910s, they paused gold convertibility and they started printing a lot of money ahead of the gold that they had sitting in the reserves to back it, in a way leading to inflation that after the war, when they had to make the decision, do we go back to the classical gold standard or not? Those two events itself is almost a break in a promise that if I had a British pound and I wanted a piece of gold, you promised me a piece of gold at a specific weight, but now that you've printed ahead of amounts of the gold, I'm getting less. So in a way, you devalued your currency. So that was that break in trust. The second part happened during World War II, where the same set of events, where Europe was still under the classical gold standard, had to print a lot of money in order to finance the war ahead of what amount of gold they had in their reserves. And then when the war ended, there was a situation where they couldn't go back to the classical gold standard, so they broke on that promise as well. And then similarly into the end of Bretton Woods. So Bretton Woods is after the classical gold standard, where the US, through their large gold reserves, became the reserve currency. And the way it worked is, so the US dollar was pegged to gold at $35 an ounce, and all other currencies were pegged to the US dollar. So most trade was in US dollar, just given that it was the link between gold and your own currency. Going into the period of the 1970s, the US accumulated a lot of gold over the years from supplying the arms in the two previous world wars. But then when it entered the Vietnam War, again, it went into this indiscriminate spending on military arms for that war, far ahead of what the gold reserves they had at hand. And that led to a point where when people wanted to convert their dollars to gold, there wasn't sufficient gold reserve. So similar to the previous World War, where you promised a certain volume, it's like, okay, I'm getting less. That's a breaking promise. So this theme of, you know, making these promises and not sticking to them, it's more of a irresponsible monetary policy. And what we've seen over the past 10 years was quantitative easing, money supply, debt burdens that have accumulated within the US Treasury. And the topic you were saying, like you have these rise in yields, weakening dollar at the same time, build up in gold reserves, is more of a reflection of we don't trust that we'll get our money back if we hold it in US Treasuries.
Umar wrapped it up really nicely there at the end, because we've also seen in 22-23 investors buying physical gold bars and coins. We saw actually some US retailers, I think was it Walmart, was offering gold coins, and they sold out within like a week. Investors really favor its independence from the stability and solvency of central banks and the entire financial system. So gold has no counterparty risk. It doesn't have any liability risk. And this comes to your question about, is this a structural shift, what we're seeing now, this current demand for gold? Well, I'd say it is, in the sense that we're living in a time, and it's quite unprecedented, where globally, sovereign debts to GDP are incredibly high. They're the highest they've been throughout history outside of wartime period. So Umar spoke to all of that spending that's taken place during wartime period to fund wars. Well, we aren't fighting a global world war right now, and yet we have various sovereigns around the world, in particular developed market sovereigns, above the threshold of 100% debt to GDP. Now, how does that get resolved? Well, I think to some degree, people are awakening to the fact that the only way it can get resolved is probably by suppressing interest rates. So if you suppress interest rates such that they are below your rate of inflation, then suddenly your interest service on all of that debt is very low. And you can actually, if tax revenue is still growing at the rate of inflation, you can grow your way out of that interest service bill. And that's the only way after the world wars that Britain, etc., was able to grow their way out of debt. So actually what it is it's a type of an invisible tax on savers. It's a type of a financial repression where you are not compensated in your, let's say, pension fund if you are holding government debt, and you are being taxed at a much faster rate than that interest you are earning. Okay, so I think investors, and this is via the gold bars and coin investments, are, you know, maybe awakening to this. And more recently, some of the rhetoric we're seeing coming out of the US, it really speaks to this fiscal dominance. Traditionally, you've got, you know, monetary policy and fiscal policy. Monetary policy is meant to target and control inflation through interest rates, and fiscal policy is something very separate. You know, now you're looking at the budget, you're looking at government spending, you know, what are you spending on, et cetera, et cetera. Under fiscal dominance, those lines become very blurred. The waters are now muddy. And we're seeing that muddiness at the moment, where you've got US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent trying to weigh in on monetary policy. You've even got US President Donald Trump trying to weigh in on monetary policy and saying, why are interest rates up here at 4%? They should be down at 1.5%. Well, the problem with 1.5% interest rate, it's not going to compensate you for inflation. And you've got these perceived efforts to try to remove Jerome Powell as Fed chairman and put in place some sort of dummy Fed chairman who, in effect, will set interest rates at a level that works for fiscal policy makers. So in other words, set interest rates low enough that governments can pay off their debt. Now, that's not meant to be the point of monetary policy. Monetary policy is meant to target inflation and set interest rates at a high enough level that you can control inflation. So people are quite concerned about that fiscal dominance. And I think that's why we're seeing, certainly exchange-traded funds have started to come into the mix and buy gold. So as I said, 2021, 22, even most of 2023, you had central banks as the underpin buyers. And then you had exchange-traded funds coming in. You had investors coming in for gold and bar and coin. And Umar raised another really interesting point. He said at these kinds of prices, so $3,300, you know, your jewelry buying starts to taper off because they're price sensitive buyers. But central banks, we found, are not necessarily price sensitive to gold. They are looking at their reserves and saying, what percentage of my reserves are in gold? It's a low percentage, specifically amongst emerging market central banks. So China, I mean, if you believe their numbers, and I don't, Umar, would you believe their numbers? No. I mean, you know, they'll say, you know, they have less than 10% of foreign exchange reserves in gold. I mean, I think it's higher, but it's not going to be knocking on the door of the 60% to 70% of reserves that the US has in gold. So for them, and I think this is such a bullish point for gold, if they want to materially alter their reserves mix in favor of gold, they're going to have to be buying a lot. Okay. And Umar, we have to discuss the demand supply dynamics.
Yes.
There isn't really enough
physical gold.
Physical gold. Well, firstly, I mean, if you look at physical gold, above ground stocks are what? It's about 200,000 tons above ground stocks. And yet the marginal supply coming into the market each year, what is it?
It's like 4,000, I think. 4,000 tons.
Yeah. 4,500 tons.
Yeah.
About 4,500. I think last year was maybe 4,700 tons of supply coming onto the market every year.
And that supply of new gold constantly.
So that's like new metal coming to the market.
If China wants to materially alter their reserves, they'd have to buy 100% of the supply coming into the market every year for several years in a row. So what would be far easier way to alter your reserve mix is if the price rises. Beginning of 2024, I did a gold report, and I think I said something like there's $13 trillion worth of above ground gold, you know, in the market. Now today, that was beginning 2024, that amounts about $21 trillion.
Probably a bit more, yeah.
Yeah. Now, that's not because we've mined so much more in that time. It's because the price has gone from $2,000 to $3,000. So all these central banks who want to have more gold in their reserve mix, the easiest way for this to happen is actually just for the price to rise. And if enough of them are bidding up gold and there's not enough supply coming to market, you know, the price has to run. So for me, that's a very important driver.
Because central bankers don't think of gold in terms of the price. They think of the $1 trillion of reserves they need to replace if they're switching out of US treasuries or the US dollar claims that they have within the FX reserves.
But I think the important thing about the central bank is that they also recognize that gold, essentially, universally recognized, it's borderless and it's free from interference, to Talia's point on the sanction of Russian reserves. And it's funny because you've got the price insensitive buyer on the one hand, and then you have the price sensitive buyer on the other hand. And you use the example of jewelry, but I think you also have to think about the example of protecting purchasing power and as a store of value for that kind of investor as well.
There's a few points that I can ask, like just from the perspective, if I was in charge of the FX reserve of these various central banks. And I mean, whether a country defaults, like actually defaults, or whether they choose to go down the route of dropping their interest rates such that there's a negative real yield against inflation, irrespective, it's a deterioration of the actual purchasing power of me holding that treasuries. So a nice example is that at the beginning of the decision to buy US Treasury, I can buy XYZ of goods. I hope to buy the same quantity of goods at the end of that holding period. But if the independence between fiscal and monetary policies deteriorate, it's very unlikely they'll be able to buy with the same amount of money, the same quantity of goods. So, I mean, gold retains that. I mean, if you had to think of a normal gold price, you'd hope to buy the same amount of bread that you bought 100 years ago, in theory, hoping that the gold price keeps growing at the same rate as where the price of bread grows over time in US dollars. It's just from the perspective of a bank is that I just need to retain or restore the value of my investment in these assets. And the increase in the gold price reflects that increase in demand that they think gold is the asset to do that.
In the US, inflation has been fairly sticky and not quite at the 2% levels that they're looking for. on the one hand, you've got your ballooning debt and he's trying to solve for a real problem in addressing this debt to GDP with tariffs. But on the other hand, you've had a very low growth environment. It's a tough economic environment for retailers, for example, to operate in. And so they're going to be presumably taking on more pressure. You can't really pass the prices on to consumers. And I think for me, it's, you know, you talked about a politically motivated interest rate cut. You've got high debt and inflation that's not really under control, which no doubt will steepen that US Treasury yield curve. And when you talk about something like safe haven assets, US Treasuries, you've discussed, has come into the play. We've talked about the US dollar, which has been weak year to date. It's probably had its worst half of the year since 1973. And in my mind, it's like, if you don't have, you know, the US Treasury or US dollar as your safe haven asset, gold is an option. But beyond that, you know, what other safe haven assets can we find ourselves or are opportunities to invest in?
So just before we go on that topic, I mean, the precarious points where you have this high debt, but you also have high inflation, so you can't do anything. I mean, the situation has happened with other central banks in the past. And I mean, they have two options, or treasuries and central bank, is firstly, the allow the government to default, but then that's a disaster because the breaking confidence in the currency already shows itself. Or they can devalue the currency where they can drop interest rates below inflation and they can print a lot of money. But then that just devalues the currency. And as bondholders or reserve asset holders, I mean, you see them as the same thing. It's a loss in the store value that you hope to maintain by holding these assets. So either way, it's in like a very precarious position to be in.
Precarious, and it's supportive, I guess,
of gold. Yes. So,
and of
hard money.
Yeah, hard money, anything that will keep up with inflation.
Yes.
So real assets.
Yes.
I think our chief investment officer, Duncan, heard this once at the World Gold Council. Somebody said, I want to own something that's real. I want to be able to drop it on my foot and it hurts. So I think it's that's providing quite a tailwind to gold right now.
Other commodities as well, they all have this inflation underpin. So moving away from gold, which is more of a store of value, to other commodities that are more utility driven. So copper, platinum and palladium, a lot of them are priced off of their cost curve, which is essentially just like the cost of the miners that are mining these metals, and they obviously need to be compensated to go underground and spend a lot of money getting the metal out of ground. So over time, there's this inflation underpinned within the price that if the cost to mine these metals go up, the price in time will also go up. So generally, just any hard commodity, hard metals have that inflation hedge element to it.
And in terms of the positioning of the Allan Gray Balance Fund, for example, what does the positioning look like between gold and other commodities in the portfolio?
So I'll use the Allan Gray Balance Fund as an example, as you mentioned. I mean, these multi-asset funds offer you the flexibility to own either the metal or the equity, whether the equity is local or offshore, assuming it's a global balance fund. And the choice to own gold as a whole, I mean, our whole topic so far gives a good case to own gold. But then by owning the metal versus equity, you are betting on certain different drivers. So why would you choose the equity over the miner? And it's more got to do with the operating leverage and the financial leverage of owning the company versus the metal. And with a miner, you are owning a stream of profits. And if the gold price goes up 100% as it has, and the costs only go up 5%, your profitability is going to open up by a much bigger margin than the underlying gold price. So this is exactly what I've experienced. I mean, Anglo Gold is our highest conviction gold call within the equity space of the balance fund. And over the past year, the gold price has gone 100%, but their earnings have gone up by multiple bags more than that. So now we've gotten to the point that the gold price is where it is, right? The average gold price over the past quarter is very close to where the spot gold price is at the moment. So what's next? We've got this tailwind in the base now. And it makes it quite tricky of how you think about your gold equities going forward. Are we hoping for another leg up on the gold price? And that is something we look at very closely, and we're doing a lot of research to assess our views on that. If it is the case that the gold price just stays flat for the next year and a half, historically, that's been a very bad time to own the gold miners. And the reason being is that, well, costs continue to go up. But once this gold price at this elevated level has been around long enough, the capital allocation decisions by these gold miners start going in favor of building new projects, going into parts of the mine that you wouldn't have gone into before because it just wasn't feasible. So to put it simply, your costs, your capex, your mergers and acquisition spending catches up to the gold price. So whilst the past 12 months have been very favorable to an investor because you've had this additional earnings, it almost gets wiped out. And I've looked at some of the gold miners over the past 30 years, and I was actually quite shocked at how quickly that gets closed out. So, I mean, I'm painting quite a morbid picture for holding the gold equity. So why do we own Anglo Gold? And I mean, initially when I started looking at Anglo Gold, that perception that the earnings disappear very quickly was very much back in mind. So I came with the point of view like, okay, show me why you're different. And after engaging with them and looking at the decisions they've made, such as investing in Obuasi before the gold rally and now benefiting it from it today. They bought Sentiment about a year or a year and a half ago, which is a very low cost mine and it's very profitable at the current gold price. But they've also exited high cost mines at the top of the cycle, which is quite unprecedented for mining companies. They're usually very pro-cyclical. So we like the decision making at Anglo Gold. The CEO has done quite a good job in convincing us that they think about value in the same way that Alan Gray, the investment team, thinks about value as well. So we like what we see, but it is something that we are monitoring on an ongoing basis and whether we do want to take on the gold equities or whether we should shift to the gold metal itself.
So capital allocation risk sounds like it's sort of contained from that perspective when it comes to Anglo Gold, for example. And I think you may have differing views on this, and it's something that I also want to go into a little bit more detail. Do you prefer the gold ETF or the gold miners?
So for me, okay, so I think Anglo Gold is a special case, but I'm, you know, in the past when I've, you know, looked at the two against each other as well in previous gold reports, definitely, you know, what Umar is saying, you know, in bullish periods, you get the miners, you know, behaving in, you know, with very destructive tendencies, levering up, they start mining lower grade areas, reopening marginal shafts, their costs go up, they spend a lot more on exploration, they also overpay for acquisitions at the peak point of the cycle. But it can be a very nice leverage play when the price is rising. And I think Umar has very nicely outlined why for Anglo, maybe we feel a bit differently. I mean, you can own both. It's not an either or. And we do own both.
Yes.
I'll make a very bullish argument for the physical metal. Well, I think it's, I mean, we've had other bullish arguments. So, I mean, a lot of people say to me, you know, their biggest challenge with the physical metal is how do you put a normal price on it? There are no valuation anchors for gold. You can't really model it. And actually, the first time I did a gold report for Alan Gray, Sandy McGregor said to me, do not put a model in the report. There's no point in modeling gold. He said, gold unfolds like a story. And I thought, okay, well, I'm still going to try and put a model in. And Sandy was 100% right. So you can model gold over certain periods with quite a high degree of predictive power in a model. So go and put in, okay, what's my expectation of real interest rates? What's my expectation of the dollar? But you can't fit that model over a multi-year period. Like no model was going to tell you that central banks are suddenly going to start buying 1,000 tons a year because they're worried about sanctions hitting them. But for me, what's quite a bullish argument, maybe in favor of the metal, is, and Umar, I don't know if you will push back against this, but this idea of peak gold. Okay, so get out your tinfoil hat with me. No, I don't think it's a tinfoil hat argument. I actually think it's a reasonable argument. But really, in the second half of the 20th century, what you found is discoveries of new, very large gold veins. So gold veins with estimated deposits of, let's say, 10 million troy ounces. They were quite common. Whereas now, you know, new gold veins are still being discovered, but discoveries of very large deposits are becoming increasingly rare. It means that most of gold production today is coming from older mines. They've already been exploited for decades. Okay. So as a result, you know, people then start to question, well, how much is there left to mine in the world? And Umar, I don't know if you believe this number. Currently, it's estimated there's only about 50,000 tons in currently identified underground gold reserves. Now that compares to 200,000 tons of above ground stocks. So, I mean, if that number's right, you've only got about 10 years worth of mining left. Okay, so it could mean we're at risk of running out. And then from a demand supply standpoint, you know, the physical metal should be, you know, very attractive in the next while. You know, if you think supply is about to, you know, could run out in the next decade, but, you know, demand's still going to be there. And, you know, about 60% of the world's mining operations now are actually just surface mines. So many of the large, very low-cost mines, for example, like ours in South Africa, are, you know, nearing exhaustion. So we're going to have to see, something's going to have to give. You're going to have to see, you know, large discoveries being, you know, taking place, or you're really going to face the issue of depleting reserves in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. Mara, I don't know if you disagree.
I don't know if I disagree with you, but there's a different way of thinking about it. I mean, I don't think anyone knows exactly how much gold is under the ground. I mean, I don't think we've explored every corner of the earth to know. But I suppose what we do know is what is the most feasible amount of gold that's in the ground. And the cure to the limited amount of reserves that you mentioned is a higher gold price. Mm-hmm. If the gold price goes to $60,000, I can guarantee you people are going to look for new deposits of gold around the world. But I mean, that's not a case against your point. It just means gold's going to go to $16,000 an ounce.
The supply-demand argument is an interesting one, because I think since 2009, there's been a very weak, if no link, between yes. supply and demand of gold. So that in itself is quite an interesting shift.
Yeah. So it hasn't been possible since 2009 to model the gold price based on annual supply versus annual demand. And I think there's a few reasons for that. Firstly, I think we've discussed the above ground stocks are just so big. So you can argue, you know, if you've got 200,000 tons of gold above ground and you're only mining whatever 4,500 tons per year, it's very marginal. And then also for me, the big one was the advent of gold exchange traded funds, gold ETFs, because suddenly this very noisy marginal player around that period, I think it was around what, 2008, 2009, started to have the loudest voice in determining the price, even though it was like very small amounts that actually trade in gold ETFs. Like, it's nothing in comparison to, you know, but the volume of jewelry we have in existence, or the annual, you know, jewelry production, but they really had the largest voice. So I think that started to also wash over or drown out what's happening on annual supply and demand.
And just the notion of a gold price is quite weird if you're very bearish on the dollar. Because, I mean, $3,300 an ounce, I mean, there's two ways of thinking of the gold rally, mm-hmm. is that, you know, the gold, more demand for the gold, but less demand for the US dollar. So the whole notion of a gold price comes into question. Like, do you then measure gold in foreign currency like yen or euros, or how much does the price of bread in terms of gold cost? So it's just a different way of thinking about the gold price.
And it is a good question. I mean, a few months ago, Goldman Sachs said gold could very well get to $4,500 an ounce. I mean, it's crazy when you think of pre-pandemic levels being at $1,600 per ounce. Mm-hmm. The gold price has basically doubled over the last 5 years. And, you know, if you listen to Goldman Sachs, then could very well keep rising. And that question is important. Is it due to dollar weakness or gold's inherent strength?
4-5 is too low. I've seen $16,000 yeah. gold estimates. But I think they're all coming across the same theme. In the sense that outside of the US, central banks are very nervous about holding US Treasury because of the reduced incentive to protect value if yields go below inflation. But because they can wake up the next morning and you don't know if the US government sanctions your or seizes your gold assets. So you've lost this trust and confidence that you'll have the gold at the end of the day. But you've also lost the trust and confidence that you'll retain value in the US Treasuries. So trying to map that theme or that trend onto a gold price is very difficult. You can make up a lot of numbers. And as Talia and I said earlier, I mean, central bankers think in terms of $1 trillion of FX reserve. They don't think about $3,300 gold or $2,000 gold. They just think we need to shift our reserves in dollar billions from one asset to the other. There's only a fixed amount of physical gold that can transfer hands within a particular period of time. So what's the natural balancing number is the gold price. And if you think that China has to quickly move their reserves from US dollars to gold in the next 5 years, I mean, you can do the math. You're going to need a much higher gold price because it's not physically possible to shift that amount of money over time.
I was playing around with it before this, at what sort of prices can China meaningfully, you know, so let's say they have, you know, 5% to 10% of reserves in gold now. Like, what does the price have to do for them to get to, let's say, a 25% target or a 50% target, whatever it might be? I mean, it's, you know, then you have to start moving many multiples. Maybe that's where your $16,000...
Is there enough gold to do that?
Well, it depends how much, you know, left of mine supply you believe there is. If you believe my, you know, 50,000 tons, you know, left below the ground, etc. It depends on that, but no, it would be very difficult for them shaving out bits of current annual supply to meaningfully alter their reserve mix. Ergo, one would have to think it has to be coming from a price move.
By having gold a bigger part of the reserve mix, there's almost like an underpin to the price. So, for example, the U.S. Treasury holds gold as well. They obviously don't want to own more. Just, you know, so that they don't debase.
It's already 70% of their reserves. Yeah.
But they've kept their official gold price on balance sheet, I think, fixed at, what, $42 an ounce from 1971 or 1973. I'm not exactly sure of the exact date. But they've kept the official value of their own gold reserves at that price. And if, let's say, China gets gold or India or Russia gets gold as a bigger part of their mix, if the gold price drops, obviously the value of that gold reserve drops with it, then it does put into question the collateral of their currency, right? So because their currency are obviously being pegged to the gold reserves. Then there's an incentive to buy more gold so that you have a sufficient amount of gold reserve to, you know, underpin your own currency. So that is also one of the reasons why there's certain discussions about the U.S. Treasury revaluing the gold price higher, because they have all this gold, but it's only at $42 versus the spot value of $3,300. Like, they can increase their reserves very quickly by just getting through Congress to increase their gold price. But then there's this natural underpin. They can't let the value of their reserves dip below that $3,300 or whatever price they choose it to be. And that's exactly what happened under Bretton Woods. The value of the dollar far exceeded what they actually had in physical gold. So they had to break the gold convertibility.
So we're talking about the limited supply of gold and that the price would naturally be the thing to move. If you keep your tin hat on with me for a little bit, what about an option of an alternative asset like crypto, for example? A lot of people have been leaning into crypto looking for, you know, ports in the storm.
So it's an interesting one. There's some, you know, common themes, you know, presumably that it's born from disillusionment in the traditional financial sector and disillusionment in government spending. So there's a bit of a, you know, dystopian fantasy that you can keep all of your money, you know, outside of traditional money networks, in a move it in across a peer-to-peer narrow money, you know, crypto exchange network. And many people have drawn, you know, in the last few years, parallels between gold and crypto in that regard. One thing, though, is that crypto, I mean, the way the price has actually moved hasn't been, you know, in a very stable kind of store of value type of fashion. It's been incredibly volatile. It's actually been very well correlated with, you know, let's say the NASDAQ or essentially risk on, risk off environments where actually when the market's feeling really risk on, like crypto's rallying hard. And then in any sort of shock or like, let's say, geopolitical risk, et cetera, crypto will sell off. So it hasn't, it's actually, you know, not very well correlated with gold at all. And I would argue it's not moving as one would expect if it's going to be a store of value or an inflation hedge or something to protect capital in a period of high inflation. In fact, in 2022, during that period of high inflation, I mean, the total cryptocurrency market cap, I think it lost like $1 trillion. It went from like $3 trillion down to $2 trillion or something bizarre. So it's almost doing the opposite of what people originally argued it would be there for.
So when you talk about protecting capital, I have to bring it back to the portfolios. So my question is, how are we balancing the gold exposure with other defensive assets in something like the Allan Gray Balanced Fund?
Well, you manage size of your position, maybe through diversification. So as much as I said, Allan Gold is our key position on the equity side. You do own a bit of the other miners. You need to be aware of the risk that you are taking when you're investing in these companies. And you diversify it through other asset classes that are very differently correlated to the gold price. So, I mean, our key positions of AB InBev and BTI are very defensive by the nature of their products. So we're balancing it across the portfolio.
it's actually been quite interesting that in the index, you're seeing a growing weight of gold, and it's actually at about 12% of the all-share index. How has this influenced allocations in the portfolio?
We are benchmark agnostic, and we try to build our positions from the bottom up and think about how the overall positioning works together that is in the best interest of our clients. The fact that gold is at, 12.5% doesn't mean I have to take on the same amount of risk that the index matches. If I think there's a lot of risk, I probably wouldn't want to own as much in a particular sector. So we try not to anchor to the benchmark just because it doesn't accurately reflect the risk reward. It could be just, you know, a mechanical thing that it grew to such a big portion of the index. It could be because other assets within the index detracted, but we don't use the benchmark weight as the bar for what we need to own within a particular sector or in an individual stock. As we say, it's the risk and rewards of that asset from the bottom up, its valuation, its operating risk, its financial risks. In this case, what do we think of the normal? Where do we think gold is going? So we try and do it from, okay, this is the asset class that we have in front of us. Do we own a lot of it, or do we not want to own a lot of it?
Maybe to Umar's point, I mean, it's not that the index reweightings are necessarily, you know, meaningful. Some of them have been quite arbitrary. So, I mean, multinationals have fallen, you know, their weight in the index has, you know, come screaming down over the last few years. Some of it has been BHP Billiton. I think it used to be about 12% of the Aussie. And then, you know, through to changes in their own internal structuring, the JSE decided we can no longer look at the offshore market cap. So we're not going to reference the Australian Exchange or the London Exchange. I mean, now it's sitting down at, I don't know, 2% of the index,
something very, yeah,
yeah, single digits, low single digits. Richemont, the same thing happened. It was, you know, reweighted down and at a point when the price was really high because of changes in the Swiss shareholding structure. So sometimes, you know, the shifts can be a little bit arbitrary. Sometimes, though, as Umar said, it can also be just because of collapses of certain sectors within the SA economy. So construction companies, this has been talked to death recently, but they used to have a really big weight in the index. And then I think with really some element of deindustrialization in South Africa, they've come down. And we've seen a lot of construction companies over the years, you know, fall to the wayside, go into business rescue, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually tend to think the high weight of gold and PGMs in the index now, so combined, gold and platinum is about 17.5% of the capped SWIX now, actually in some ways reflects a deindustrialization of South Africa. And we're moving back to maybe what the economy looked like, kind of, I don't know, 1990s sort of period when we were really just, you know, a mining play. And then from there, all these value-added sectors kind of sprung up and some of them have now started to fail. So you could say maybe the index is a more accurate representation of the SA economy, which is really, you know, we've got banks and we've got platinum group metals and we've got gold and those are our big drivers. But that doesn't mean it's an should be, you know, how an investor's portfolio looks. So it doesn't mean you want a portfolio that's, you know, completely aligned with whatever the growth areas are in the SA economy. You know, you want to be, you know, diversified in some sense or have, you know, fairer weights in various assets.
Well, if you want to do really well on your portfolio, you probably have to be different.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just going to get an index return.
Which is a great place for a contrarian investor like ourselves to be. I think before we wrap up, one final thing. I read something recently that said equity traders are paid to be optimistic and bullish, whereas currency and fixed income traders are paid to be sort of pessimistic and bearish. And you see that coming through in what we're seeing in global markets broadly. So we've been talking very bullishly about gold. What would it take? What kind of conditions would it take for the gold price to actually fall?
The biggest cure to gold being a safe haven is productivity growth. And I use productivity in a more broader sense, not necessarily just getting more goods out of your effort. It's also you can get it through lower marginal cost. And I think I've shared this example with you, Talia, about how inflation doesn't really factor in the improving standard of living or the utility that you get out of things like technology. And the example I've always used is Netflix. So, I mean, let's dial back 20 years ago. I mean, I don't think Netflix was around. But if it was around, the internet was probably too slow or too expensive, or we didn't have the technology we had today to watch a high-quality video, for example. So, probably impossible to do it. But another way of framing that is that it was infinitely expensive to do so. I mean, today you can spend a couple of hundred rand to get internet, can get a subscription to Netflix, and you can watch anything on demand. So you've gone from a point where it was infinitely expensive to watch anything on demand to spending a couple of hundred rand. I mean, by definition, that sounds like deflation to me from a utility perspective. So things like technology have probably been the most deflationary factor over the past 30 years. And then there's this talk about AI and robotics that's going to change the world. We're all going to be fun employed, and there's going to be this age of abundance where everything's going to be near zero. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but if it does happen and you have this burst of productivity, real GDP growth, then the debt burden today doesn't look that big. It'll sort itself out. And in that case, it's probably a bad time to hold gold.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to believe in super growth to grow out of, you know, 100% debt to GDP.
Yeah.
And I mean, 100% is just sort of where you are now.
Yes.
If you, you know, take a look at Trump's one big, beautiful bill and factor in kind of what that's going to add to the deficit, you can easily get to a space, you know, in the next 10 years where, you know, maybe debt's knocking on the door of 140% debt to GDP, where more than 30 cents on every tax dollar is going towards servicing interest. Unless, of course, you know, you've suppressed interest rates. But yeah, I mean, I take Omar's point. If you get some sort of super productivity from AI and it leads to disinflation, then then actually a real asset like gold probably not going to shine as much as it would have.
And perhaps greater market certainty, calming of geopolitical tension.
I don't think that's going to happen, Horatio. We're now moving into more, you know, the kind of pre-Cold War period where you've got a lot of tensions between, let's say, the China BRICS bloc versus the Western bloc. And
so the peace dividend is firmly over.
The damage is done. It takes a very long time to build trust, but then once it's broken, it's properly broken. Like during times in the past, like once it's broken, you're more likely to see a shift in regime to another currency or another country, whether it's from Britain to the US, and who knows who's next.
Rise and fall of nations, which is also probably a good time to hold gold.
Yes. Yeah.
And on that note, thank you to Talia and Umar for joining me for this thought-provoking conversation, and thank you for listening. So in this conversation, we discussed that in uncertain market environments, the diversification of assets in your portfolio allow you to protect your purchasing power over the long term. Challenging long-held beliefs is important as it allows you to recognize and take advantage of opportunities as they arise. And the third takeaway is that while uncomfortable, change is often crucial for progress. And sometimes waiting on the sidelines for the perfect entry may erode investment growth over the long term. It's important that fundamental research is your key underpin. So to take an adapted quotation from William Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice, all that glitters is not gold. Not everything that appears attractive or valuable is actually so. And it stresses the importance of looking for true intrinsic value. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@alangray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Alan Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit alangray.co.za. Until next time, I am Horatia Naidu McCarthy. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Alan Gray. Long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.